various factors. The heavy lids drooped over his eyes for a moment, but he still held my hand.
I have heard that your husband interests himself in the affairs of my cousin, he said.
Your Majesty is well informed, I said politely. But since that is so, you will know that my husband does not support the restoration of the Stuarts to the throne of Scotland. I prayed that this was what he wanted to hear. Apparently it was. He smiled, raised my hand to his lips, and kissed it briefly.
Ah, I had heard conflicting stories about your husband.
I took a deep breath and resisted the impulse to snatch my hand back. Well, it's a matter of business, I said, trying to sound as matter-of-fact as possible. My husband's cousin, Jared Fraser, is an avowed Jacobite. Jamie, my husband, can't very well go about letting his real views be made public when he's in partnership with Jared. Seeing the doubt begin to fade from his face, I hurried it along. Ask Monsieur Duveney, I suggested. He's well acquainted with my husband's true sympathies.
I have.
Louis paused for a long moment, watching his own fingers, dark and stubby, tracing delicate circles over the back of my hand.
So very pale, he murmured. So fine. I believe I could see the blood flow beneath your skin.
He let go of my hand then, and sat regarding me. I was extremely good at reading faces, but Louis's was quite impenetrable at the moment. I realized suddenly that he'd been a king since the age of 5. The ability to hide his thoughts was as much a part of him as his Bourbon nose or the sleepy black eyes. This thought brought another in its wake, with a chill that struck me deep in the pit of the stomach. He was the king. The citizens of Paris wouldn't rise for 40 years or more. Until that day, his rule within France was absolute. He could free Jamie with a word, or kill him. He could do with me as he liked. There was no recourse. One nod of his head, and the coffers of France could spill the gold that would launch Charles Stuart, loosing him like a deadly bolt of lightning to strike through the heart of Scotland. He was the king. He would do as he wished. And I watched his dark eyes, clouded with thought, and waited, trembling, to see what the royal pleasure might be.
"Tell me, ma chère madame," he said at last, stirring from his introspection. "If I were to grant your request to free your husband..."
He paused, considering. "Yes?"
"He would have to leave France," Louis said, one thick brow raised in warning. "That would be a condition of his release."
"I understand." My heart was pounding so hard that it nearly drowned out his words. Jamie leaving France was, after all, precisely the point. But he's exiled from Scotland.
I think that might be arranged.
I hesitated, but there seemed little choice but to agree on Jamie's behalf. All right.
Good.
The king nodded, pleased. Then his eyes returned to me, rested on my face, glided down my neck, my breasts, my body.
"I would ask a small service of you in return, madame," he said softly.
I met his eyes squarely for 1 second. Then I bowed my head. "I am at your Majesty's complete disposal," I said.
"Ah."
He rose and threw off the dressing gown, leaving it flung carelessly over the back of his armchair. He smiled and held out a hand to me.
"Très bien, ma chère. Come with me, then."
I closed my eyes briefly, willing my knees to work. "You've been married 2 times, for heaven's sake," I thought to myself. "Quit making such a bloody fuss about it." I rose to my feet and took his hand. To my surprise, he didn't turn toward the velvet chaise, but instead led me toward the door at the far side of the room. I had one moment of ice-cold clarity as he let go my hand to open the door.
"Damn you, Jamie Fraser," I thought. "Damn you to hell." I stood quite still on the threshold, blinking, my meditations on the protocol of royal disrobing fading into sheer astonishment. The room was quite dark, lit only by numerous tiny oil lamps set in groups of five in alcoves in the wall of the chamber. The room itself was round, and so was the huge table that stood in its centre, the dark wood gleaming with pinpoint reflections. There were people sitting at the table, no more than hunched dark blurs against the blackness of the room. There was a murmur at my entrance, quickly stilled at the king's appearance. As my eyes grew more accustomed to the murk, I realised with a sense of shock that the people seated at the table wore hoods. The nearest man turned toward me, and I caught the faint gleam of eyes through the holes in the velvet. It looked like a convention of hangmen. Apparently, I was the guest of honour. I wondered for a nervous moment just what might be expected of me. From Raymond's hints and Marguerite's, I had nightmare visions of occult ceremonies involving infant sacrifice, ceremonial rape, and general-purpose satanic rites. It is, however, quite rare for the supernatural actually to live up to its billing, and I hoped this occasion would be no exception. "We have heard of your great skill, madame, and your reputation." Louis smiled, but there was a tinge of caution in his eyes as he looked at me, as though not quite certain what I might do. "We should be most obliged, my dear madame, should you be willing to give us the benefits of such skill this evening."
I nodded. "Most obliged, eh? Well, that was all to the good. I wanted him obliged to me. What was he expecting me to do, though?"
A servant placed a huge wax candle on the table and lighted it, shedding a pool of mellow light on the polished wood. The candle was decorated with symbols like those I had seen in Master Raymond's secret chamber.
"Regardez, madame."
The king's hand was under my elbow, directing my attention beyond the table. Now that the candle was lighted, I could see the two figures who stood silently among the flickering shadows. I started at the sight, and the king's hand tightened on my arm. The Comte Saint-Germain and Master Raymond stood there, side by side, separated by a distance of 6 feet or so. Raymond gave no sign of acknowledgement, but stood quietly, staring off to one side with the pupilless black eyes of a frog in a bottomless well.
The Comte saw me, and his eyes widened in disbelief, and he scowled at me.
He was dressed in his finest, all in white, as usual. A white stiffened satin coat over cream-coloured silk vest and breeches. A tracery of seed pearls decorated his cuffs and the pearls gleaming in the candlelight. Sartorial splendour aside, the Comte looked rather the worse for wear, I thought. His face was drawn with strain, and the lace of his stock was wilted, his collar darkened with sweat. Raymond, conversely, looked calm as a turbot on ice, standing stolidly with both hands folded into the sleeves of his usual scruffy velvet robe, broad, flat face placid and inscrutable.
"These two men stand accused, madame," said Louis, with a gesture at Raymond and the Comte, "of sorcery, of witchcraft, of the perversion of the legitimate search for knowledge into an exploration of arcane arts."
His voice was cold and grim.
"Such practices flourished during the reign of my grandfather, but we shall not suffer such wickedness in our realm."
The king flicked his fingers at one of the hooded figures who sat with pen and ink before a sheaf of papers.
"Read the indictments, if you please," he said.
The hooded man rose obediently to his feet and began to read from one of the papers. Charges of bestiality and foul sacrifice, of the spilling of the blood of innocents, the profanation of the most holy rite of the Mass by desecration of the hosts, the performance of amatory rites upon the altar of God. I had a quick flash of just what the healing Raymond had performed on me at L'Hôpital des Anges must have looked like, and felt profoundly grateful that no one had discovered him. I heard the name Du Carrefour mentioned, and swallowed a sudden rising of bile. What had Pastor Laurent said? The sorcerer Du Carrefour had been burned in Paris only 20 years before on just such charges as those I was hearing. The summoning of demons and the powers of darkness, the procurement of illness and death for payment. I put a hand to my stomach in vivid memory of bitter cascara. The ill-wishing of members of the court, the defilement of virgins. I shot a quick look at the comte, but his face was stony, lips pressed tight as he listened. Raymond stood quite still, silver hair brushing his shoulders, as though listening to something as inconsequential as the song of a thrush in the bushes. I had seen the cabalistic symbols on his cabinet, but I could hardly reconcile the man I knew, the compassionate poisoner, the practical apothecary, with the list of vileness being read. At last, the indictments ceased. The hooded man glanced at the king, and at a signal sank back into his chair.
"Extensive inquiry has been made," the king said, turning to me. "Evidence has been presented, and the testimony of many witnesses taken. It seems clear." He turned a cold gaze on the two accused magi. "That both men have undertaken investigations into the writings of ancient philosophers, and have employed the art of divinations, using calculation of the movements of heavenly bodies. Still," he shrugged, "this is not of itself a crime. I am given to understand."
He glanced at a heavy-set man in a hood, whom I suspected of being the Bishop of Paris.
"That this is not necessarily at variance with the teachings of the Church. Even the blessed Saint Augustine was known to have made inquiries into the mysteries of astrology."
I rather dimly recall that Saint Augustine had indeed looked into astrology, and had rather scornfully dismissed it as a load of rubbish. Still, I doubted that Louis had read Augustine's Confessions, and this line of argument was undoubtedly a good one for an accused sorcerer. Stargazing seemed fairly harmless, by comparison with infant sacrifice and nameless orgies. I was beginning to wonder, with considerable apprehension, just what I was doing in this assemblage. Had someone seen Master Raymond with me in the hôpital, after all?
"We have no quarrel with the proper use of knowledge, nor the search for wisdom,"
the king went on in measured tones.
"There is much that can be learned from the writings of the ancient philosophers if they are approached with proper caution and humility of spirit. But it is true that while much good may be found in such writings, so too evil may be discovered, and the pure search for wisdom be perverted into the desire for power and wealth, the things of this world."
He glanced back and forth between the two accused sorcerers once more, obviously drawing conclusions as to who might be more inclined to that sort of perversion. The comte was still sweating, damp patches showing dark on the white silk of his coat.
"No, Your Majesty," he said, shaking back his dark hair and fixing burning eyes on Master Raymond. "It is true that there are dark forces at work in the land, the vileness of which you speak walks among us. But such wickedness does not dwell in the breast of your most loyal subject."
He smote himself on the breast, lest we have missed the point.
"No, Your Majesty. For the perversion of knowledge and the use of forbidden arts, you must look beyond your own court."
He didn't accuse Master Raymond directly, but the direction of his pointed gaze was obvious. The king was unmoved by this outburst.
"Such abominations flourished during the reign of my grandfather," he said softly. "We have rooted them out, wherever they have been found, destroyed the threat of such evil where it shall exist in our realm. Sorcerers, witches, those who pervert the teachings of the Church. Monsieur, we shall not suffer such wickedness to rise again." So,
he slapped both palms lightly against the table and straightened himself. Still staring at Raymond and the comte, He held out a hand in my direction.
"We have brought here a witness," he declared. "An infallible judge of truth, of purity of heart."
I made a small gurgling noise, which made the king turn to look at me.
"A white lady," he said softly. "La Dame Blanche cannot lie. She sees the heart and the soul of a man, and may turn that truth to good or to destruction."
The air of unreality that had hung over the evening vanished in a pop. The faint wine buzz was gone, and I was suddenly stone-cold sober. I opened my mouth and then shut it, realizing that there was precisely nothing I could say. Horror snaked down my backbone and coiled in my belly as the king made his dispositions. Two pentagrams were to be drawn on the floor, within which the two sorcerers would stand. Each would then bear witness to his own activities and motives, and the white lady would judge the truth of what was said. "Jesus H. Christ," I said, under my breath.
"Monsieur le Comte."
The king gestured to the first pentagram chalked on the carpet. Only a king would treat a genuine Aubusson with that kind of cavalier disregard. The Comte brushed close to me as he went to take his place. As he passed me, I caught the faintest whisper.
"Be warned, madame, I do not work alone."
He took up his spot and turned to face me with an ironic bow, outwardly composed. The implication was reasonably clear. I condemned him, and his minions would be round promptly to cut off my nipples and burn Jared's warehouse. I licked dry lips, cursing Louis. Why couldn't he have just wanted my body? Raymond stepped casually into his own chalk-limbed space and nodded cordially in my direction. No hint of guidance in those round black eyes. I hadn't the faintest idea what to do next. The king motioned to me to stand opposite him between the two pentagrams. The hooded men rose to stand behind the king, a blank-faced crowd of menace. Everything was extremely quiet. Candle smoke hung in a pall near the gilded ceiling, wisps drifting the languid air currents. All eyes were trained on me. Finally, out of desperation, I turned to the Comte and nodded. "You may begin, Monsieur le Comte," I said. He smiled, at least I assumed it was meant to be a smile, and began, starting out with an explication of the foundation of the Kabbalah and moving right along to an exegesis on the 23 letters of the Hebrew alphabet and the profound symbolism of it all. It sounded thoroughly scholarly, completely innocuous, and terribly dull. The king yawned, not bothering to cover his mouth. Meanwhile, I was turning over alternatives in my mind. This man had threatened and attacked me, and tried to have Jamie assassinated. Whether for personal or political reasons, it made little difference. He had, in all likelihood, been the ringleader of the gang of rapists who had waylaid me and Mary. Beyond all this, and beyond the rumours I had heard of his other activities, he was a major threat to the success of our attempt at stopping Charles Stuart. Was I going to let him get away? Let him go on to exert his influence with the king on the Stuart's behalf, and to go on roaming the darkened streets of Paris with his band of masked bullies? I could see my nipples, erect with fright, standing out boldly against the silk of my dress. But I drew myself up and glared at him anyway. "Just 1 minute," I said. "All that you say so far is true, Monsieur le Comte. But I see a shadow behind your words." The Comte's mouth fell open. Louis, suddenly interested, ceased slouching against the table and stood upright. I closed my eyes and laid my fingers against my lids as though looking inward. "I see a name in your mind, Monsieur le Comte," I said. I sounded breathless and half-choked with fright, but there was no help for it. I dropped my hands and looked straight at him. "Les disciples du mal," I said. "What have you to do with les disciples, Monsieur le Comte?" He really wasn't good at hiding his emotions. His eyes bulged and his face went white, and I felt a small, fierce surge of satisfaction under my fear. The name of Les Disciples du Mal was familiar to the king as well. The sleepy, dark eyes narrowed suddenly to slits. The comte may have been a crook and a charlatan, but he wasn't a coward. Summoning his resources, he glared at me and flung back his head. "This woman lies," he said, sounding as definite as he had when informing the audience that the letter Aleph was symbolic of the font of Christ's blood. "She is no true white lady, but the servant of Satan, in league with her master, the notorious sorcerer, Du Carrefour's apprentice." He pointed dramatically at Raymond, who looked mildly surprised. One of the hooded men crossed himself, and I heard the soft whisper of a brief prayer among the shadows. "I can prove what I say," the comte declared, not letting anyone else get a word in edgewise. He reached into the breast of his coat. I remembered the dagger he had produced from his sleeve on the night of the dinner party, and tensed myself to duck. It wasn't a knife that he brought out, though. "The Holy Bible says, 'They shall handle serpents unharmed,'" he thundered. "And by such signs shall ye know the servants of the true God." I thought it was probably a small python. It was nearly 3 feet long, a smooth, gleaming length of gold and brown, slick and sinuous as oiled rope, with a pair of disconcerting golden eyes. There was a concerted gasp at its appearance, and two of the hooded judges took a quick step back. Louis himself was more than slightly taken aback, and looked hastily about for his bodyguard, who stood goggle-eyed by the door of the chamber. The snake flicked its tongue once or twice, tasting the air, apparently deciding that the mix of candle-wax and incense wasn't edible. It turned and made an attempt to burrow back into the warm pocket from which it had been so rudely removed. The comte caught it expertly behind the head and shoved it toward me. "You see," he said triumphantly, "the woman shrinks away in fear. She is a witch." Actually, compared to one judge who was huddling against the far wall, I was a monument of fortitude. But I must admit that I had taken an involuntary step backward when the snake appeared. Now I stepped forward again, intending to take it away from him. The bloody thing wasn't poisonous after all. Maybe we'd see how harmless it was if I wrapped it round his neck. Before I could reach him, though, Master Raymond spoke behind me. What with all the commotion, I'd rather forgotten him.
"That is not all the Bible says, Monsieur le Comte," Raymond observed.
He didn't raise his voice, and the wide amphibian face was bland as pudding. Still, the buzz of voices stopped, and the king turned to listen.
"Yes, monsieur," he said.
Raymond nodded in polite acknowledgement of having the floor, and reached into his robe with both hands. From one pocket he produced a flask, from the other a small cup.
"They shall handle serpents unharmed," he quoted, "and if they drink any deadly poison, they shall not die."
He held the cup out on the palm of his hand, its silver lining gleaming in the candlelight. The flask was poised above it, ready to pour.
"Since both Milady Brochturoch and myself have been accused," Raymond said, with a quick glance at me, "I would suggest that all three of us partake of this test, with your permission, Your Majesty."
Louis looked rather stunned by the rapid progress of events, but he nodded, and a thin stream of amber liquid splashed into the cup, which at once turned red and began to bubble as though the contents were boiling.
"Dragon's blood," Raymond said informatively, waving at the cup. "Entirely harmless to the pure of heart."
He smiled a toothless, encouraging smile, and handed me the cup. There didn't seem much to do but drink it. Dragon's blood appeared to be some form of sodium bicarbonate. It tasted like brandy with seltzer. I took two or three medium-sized swallows and handed it back. With due ceremony, Raymond drank as well. He lowered the cup, exhibiting pink-stained lips, and turned to the king.
"'If la dame blanche may be asked to give the cup to Monsieur le Comte,' he said.
He gestured to the chalk lines at his feet to indicate that he might not step outside the protection of the pentagram. At the king's nod, I took the cup and turned mechanically toward the Comte. Perhaps 6 feet of carpeting to cross. I took the first step, and then another, knees trembling more violently than they had in the small anteroom, alone with the king. The White Lady sees a man's true nature. Did I? Did I really know about either of them, Raymond or the Comte? Could I have stopped it? I asked myself that 100 times, 1,000 times, later. Could I have done otherwise? I remembered my errant thought on meeting Charles Stuart. How convenient for everyone if he should die. But one cannot kill a man for his beliefs, even if the exercise of those beliefs means the death of innocence. Or can one? I didn't know. I didn't know that the Comte was guilty. I didn't know that Raymond was innocent. I didn't know whether the pursuit of an honourable cause justified the use of dishonourable means. I didn't know what one life was worth or 1,000. I didn't know the true cost of revenge. I did know that the cup I held in my hands was death. The white crystal hung around my neck, its weight a reminder of poison. I hadn't seen Raymond add anything to it. No one had, I was sure. But I didn't need to dip the crystal into the blood-red liquid to know what it now contained. The Comte saw the knowledge in my face. La Dame Blanche cannot lie. He hesitated, looking at the bubbling cup.
Drink, monsieur, said the king.
The dark eyes were hooded once more, showing nothing.
Or are you afraid?
The Comte might have a number of things to his discredit, but cowardice wasn't one of them. His face was pale and set, but he met the king's eyes squarely with a slight smile.
No, Majesty, he said.
He took the cup from my hand and drained it, his eyes fixed on mine. They stayed fixed, staring into my face even as they glazed with the knowledge of death. The White Lady may turn a man's nature to good or to destruction. The Comte's body hit the floor, writhing, and a chorus of shouts and cries rose from the hooded watchers, drowning any sound he might have made. His heels drummed briefly, silently, on the flowered carpet. His body arched, then subsided into limpness. The snake, thoroughly disgruntled, struggled free of the disordered folds of white satin and slithered rapidly away, heading for the sanctuary of Louis's feet. All was pandemonium. Chapter 28 The Coming of the Light. I returned from Paris to Louise's house at Fontainebleau. I didn't want to go to the Rue Trimoulin, or anywhere else that Jamie might find me. He would have little time to look. He would have to leave for Spain virtually at once, or risk the failure of his scheme. Louise, good friend that she was, forgave my subterfuge, and, to her credit, forbore to ask me where I had gone or what I had done there. I didn't speak much to anyone, but stayed in my room, eating little, and staring at the fat, naked putti that decorated the white ceiling. The sheer necessity of the trip to Paris had roused me for a time, but now there was nothing I must do, no daily routine to support me. Rudderless, I began to drift again. Still, I tried sometimes to make an effort. Prodded by Louise, I would come down to a social dinner, or join her for tea with a visiting friend. And I tried to pay attention to Fergus, the only person in the world for whom I had still some sense of responsibility. So, when I heard his voice raised in altercation on the other side of an outbuilding as I dutifully took my afternoon walk, I felt obliged to go and see what was the matter. He was face to face with one of the stable lads, a bigger boy with a sullen expression and broad shoulders.
"Shut your mouth, ignorant toad," the stable lad was saying. "You don't know what you're talking about."
"I know better than you. You whose mother mated with a pig."
Fergus put two fingers in his nostrils, pushed his nose up, and danced to and fro, shouting, "Oink, oink," repeatedly. The stable lad, who did have a rather noticeably upturned proboscis, wasted no time in idle repartee, but waded in with both fists clenched and swinging. Within seconds, the two were rolling on the muddy ground, squalling like cats and ripping at each other's clothes. While I was still debating whether to interfere, the stable lad rolled on top of Fergus, got his neck in both hands, and began to bang his head on the ground. On the one hand, I rather considered that Fergus had been inviting some such attention. On the other, his face was turning a dark, dusky red, and I had some reservations about seeing him cut off in his prime. With a certain amount of deliberation, I walked up behind the struggling pair. The stable lad was kneeling astride Fergus's body, choking him, and the seat of his breeches was stretched tight before me. I drew back my foot and booted him smartly in the trouser seam. Precariously balanced, he fell forward with a startled cry atop the body of his erstwhile victim. He rolled to the side and bounced to his feet, fists clenched. Then he saw me, and fled without a word. "What do you think you're playing at?" I demanded. I yanked Fergus, gasping and spluttering to his feet, and began to beat his clothes, knocking the worst of the mud clumps and hay wisps off of him. "Look at that," I said accusingly. "You've torn not only your shirt but your breeches as well. We'll have to ask Berta to mend them." I turned him around and fingered the torn flap of fabric. The stable lad had apparently gotten a hand in the waistband of the breeches and ripped them down the side seam. The buckram fabric drooped from his slender hips, all but bearing one buttock. I stopped talking suddenly and stared. It wasn't the disgraceful expanse of bare flesh that riveted me, but a small red mark that adorned it. About the size of a halfpenny piece, it was the dark, purplish-red colour of a freshly healed burn. Disbelievingly, I touched it, making Fergus start in alarm. The edges of the mark were incised. Whatever had made it had sunk into the flesh. I grabbed the boy by the arm to stop him running away, and bent to examine the mark more closely. At a distance of 6 inches, the shape of the mark was clear. It was an oval, carrying within it smudged shapes that must have been letters. "Who did this to you, Fergus?" I asked. My voice sounded queer to my own ears, preternaturally calm and detached. Fergus yanked, trying to pull away, but I held on. "Who, Fergus?" I demanded, giving him a little shake.
"It's nothing, madame. I hurt myself sliding off the fence. It's just a splinter."
His large black eyes darted to and fro, seeking a refuge. "That's not a splinter. I know what it is, Fergus, but I want to know who did it." I had seen something like it only once before, and that wound freshly inflicted, while this had had some time to heal. But the mark of a brand is unmistakable. Seeing that I meant it, he quit struggling. He licked his lips, hesitating, but his shoulders slumped, and I knew I had him now.
"It was an Englishman, milady, with a ring."
"When?"
"A long time ago, madame. In May."
I drew a deep breath, calculating. 3 months. 3 months earlier, when Jamie had left the house to visit a brothel in search of his warehouse foreman. In Fergus's company. 3 months since Jamie had encountered Jack Randall in Madame Elise's establishment and seen something that made all promises null and void, that had formed in him the determination to kill Jack Randall. 3 months since he had left, never to return. It took considerable patience, supplemented by a firm grip on Fergus's upper arm, but I succeeded at last in extracting the story from him. When they arrived at Madame Elise's establishment, Jamie had told Fergus to wait for him while he went upstairs to make the financial arrangements. Judging from prior experience that this might take some time, Fergus had wandered into the large salon, where a number of young ladies that he knew were resting, chattering together, and fixing each other's hair in anticipation of customers.
"Business is sometimes slow in the mornings," he explained to me, "but on Tuesdays and Fridays, the fishermen come up the Seine to sell their catch at the morning market. Then they have money. And Madame Elise does a fine business, so les jeunes filles must be ready right after breakfast."
Most of the girls were, in fact, the older inhabitants of the establishment. Fishermen were not considered the choicest of clients, and so went by default to the less desirable prostitutes. Among these were most of Fergus's former friends, though, and he passed an agreeable quarter of an hour in the salon, being petted and teased. A few early clients appeared, made their choice, and departed for the upstairs rooms. Madame Elise's house boasted 4 narrow stories, without disturbing the conversation of the remaining ladies.
"And then the Englishman came in with Madame Elise."
Fergus stopped and swallowed, the large Adam's apple bobbing uneasily in his skinny throat. It was obvious to Fergus, who had seen men in every state of inebriation and arousal, that the captain had been making a night of it. He was flushed and untidy, and his eyes were bloodshot. Ignoring Madame Elise's attempts to guide him toward one of the prostitutes, he had broken away and wandered through the room, restlessly scanning the wares on display. Then his eye had lighted on Fergus.
He said, "You, come along," and took me by the arm. I held back, madame. I told him my employer was above and that I couldn't. But he wouldn't listen. Madame Elise whispered in my ear that I should go with him, and she would split the money with me afterward.
Fergus shrugged and looked at me helplessly.
I knew the ones who, like little boys, don't usually take very long. I thought he would be finished long before Milor was ready to leave.
"Jesus bloody Christ," I said. My fingers relaxed their grip and slid nervelessly down his sleeve.
"Do you mean, Fergus, had you done it before?"
He looked as though he wanted to cry. So did I.
"Not very often, madame," he said,
and it was almost a plea for understanding.
"There are houses where that is the speciality, and usually the men who like that go there. But sometimes a customer would see me and take a fancy."
His nose was starting to run, and he wiped it with the back of his hand. I rummaged in my pocket for a handkerchief and gave it to him. He was beginning to sniffle as he recalled that Friday morning.
"He was much bigger than I thought. I asked him if I could take it in my mouth, but he wanted to."
I pulled him to me and pressed his head tight against my shoulder, muffling his voice in the cloth of my gown. The frail blades of his shoulder bones were like a bird's wings under my hand.
"Don't tell me any more," I said. "Don't."
"It's all right, Fergus. I'm not angry. But don't tell me any more." This was a futile order. He couldn't stop talking after so many days of fear and silence.
"But it's all my fault, madame," he burst out, pulling away. His lip was trembling and tears welled in his eyes. "I should have kept quiet. I shouldn't have cried out. But I couldn't help it, and Milor heard me, and he burst in and... Oh, madame, I shouldn't have, but I was so glad to see him, I ran to him. And he put me behind him and hit the Englishman in the face. Then the Englishman came up from the floor with a stool in his hands and threw it, and I was so afraid, I ran out of the room and hid in the closet at the end of the hall. Then there was so much shouting and banging and a terrible crash and more shouting. And then it stopped, and soon Milor opened the door of the closet and took me out. He had my clothes, and he dressed me himself because I couldn't fasten the buttons. My fingers shook.
He grabbed my skirt with both hands, the necessity of making me believe him, tightening his face into a monkey mask of grief.
"It's my fault, madame. But I didn't know. I didn't know he would go to fight the Englishman. And now Milor is gone and he'll never come back, and it's all my fault."
Wailing now, he fell face down on the ground at my feet. He was crying so loudly that I didn't think he heard me as I bent to lift him up. But I said it anyway. "It isn't your fault, Fergus. It isn't mine either. But you're right. He's gone." Following Fergus's revelation, I sank ever deeper into apathy. The grey cloud that had surrounded me since the miscarriage seemed to draw closer, wrapping me in swaddling folds that dimmed the light of the brightest day. Sounds seemed to reach me faintly, like the far-off ringing of a buoy through fog at sea. Louise stood in front of me, frowning worriedly as she looked down at me. "You're much too thin," she scolded, "and white as a plate of tripes. Yvonne said you didn't eat any breakfast again." I couldn't remember when I had last been hungry. It hardly seemed important. Long before the Bois de Boulogne, long before my trip to Paris. I fixed my gaze on the mantelpiece and drifted off into the curlicues of the Rococo carving. Louise's voice went on, but I didn't pay attention. It was only a noise in the room, like the brushing of a tree branch against the stone wall of the chateau, or the humming of the flies that had been drawn in by the smell of my discarded breakfast. I watched one of them, rising off the eggs in sudden motion as Louise clapped her hands. It buzzed in short, irritable circles before settling back to its feeding spot. The sound of hurrying footsteps came behind me. There was a sharp order from Louise, a submissive, "Oui, madame," and the sudden flap of a fly whisk, as the maid set about removing the flies one by one. She dropped each small black corpse into her pocket, plucking it off the table, and polishing the smear left behind with a corner of her apron. Louise bent down, thrusting her face suddenly into my field of view. "I can see all the bones in your face. If you won't eat, at least go outside for a bit," she said impatiently. "The rain stopped. Come along, and we'll see if there are any muscats left in the arbour. Maybe you'll eat some of those." Outside or inside was much the same to me. The soft, numbing greyness was still with me, blurring outlines, and making every place seem like every other. But it seemed to matter to Louise, so I rose obediently to go with her. Near the garden door, though, she was waylaid by the cook, with a list of questions and complaints about the menu for dinner. Guests had been invited with the intention of distracting me, and the bustle of preparation had been causing small explosions of domestic discord all morning. Louise emitted a martyred sigh, then patted me on the back. "You go on," she said, urging me toward the door. "I'll send a footman with your cloak." It was a cool day for August, because of the rain that had been coming down since the night before. Pools of water lay in the gravelled paths, and the dripping from the drenched trees was nearly as incessant as the rain itself. The sky was still filled with grey, but it had faded from the angry black of waterlogged cloud. I folded my arms around my elbows. It looked as though the sun might come out soon, but it was still cold enough to want a cloak. When I heard footsteps behind me on the path, I turned to find François, the second footman, but he carried nothing. He looked oddly hesitant, peering as though to make sure I was the person he was looking for. "Madame," he said, "there is a visitor for you." I sighed internally. I didn't want to be bothered with the effort of rousing myself to be civil to company. "Tell them I'm indisposed, please," I said, turning to continue my walk. "And when they've gone, bring me my cloak." "But, madame," he said behind me, "it is le Seigneur Bourtouroch, your husband." Startled, I whirled to look at the house. It was true. I could see Jamie's tall figure already coming around the corner of the house. I turned, pretending I hadn't seen him, and walked off toward the arbour. The shrubbery was thick down there. Perhaps I could hide. "Claire." Pretending was useless. He had seen me as well, and was coming down the path after me. I walked faster, but I was no match for those long legs.
I was puffing before I had covered half the distance to the arbour, and had to slow down. I was in no condition for strenuous exercise.
"Wait, Claire!"
I half turned. He was almost upon me. The soft grey numbness around me quivered, and I felt a sort of frozen panic at the thought that the sight of him might rip it away from me. If it did, I would die, I thought, like a grub dug up from the soil and tossed onto a rock to shrivel, naked and defenceless in the sun. "No," I said, "I don't want to talk to you. Go away." He hesitated for a moment, and I turned away from him and began to walk rapidly down the path toward the arbour. I heard his steps on the gravel of the path behind me, but kept my back turned and walked faster, almost running. As I paused to duck under the arbour, he made a sudden lunge forward and grasped my wrist. I tried to pull away from him, but he held on tight.
"Claire," he said again.
I struggled, but kept my face turned away. If I didn't look at him, I could pretend he wasn't there. I could stay safe. He let go of my wrist, but grabbed me by both shoulders instead, so that I had to lift my head to keep my balance. His face was sunburned and thin, with harsh lines cut beside his mouth, and his eyes above were dark with pain.
"Claire," he said more softly now that he could see me looking at him. "Claire, it was my child, too."
"Yes, it was, and you killed it."
I ripped away from him, flinging myself through the narrow arch.
I stopped inside, panting like a terrified dog. I hadn't realized that the arch led into a tiny, vine-covered folly. Latticed walls surrounded me on all sides. I was trapped. The light behind me failed as his body blocked the arch. "Don't touch me!" I backed away, staring at the ground. "Go away," I thought frantically. "Please, for God's sake, leave me in peace." I could feel my grey wrappings being inexorably stripped away, and small bright streaks of pain shot through me like lightning bolts piercing cloud. He stopped a few feet away. I stumbled blindly toward the latticed wall and half sat, half fell onto a wooden bench. I closed my eyes and sat shivering. While it was no longer raining, it was a cold, damp wind coming through the lattice to chill my neck. He didn't come closer. I could feel him standing there, looking down at me. I could hear the raggedness of his breathing.
"Claire,"
he said once more, with something like despair in his voice.
"Claire, do you not see? Claire, you must speak to me. For God's sake, Claire. I don't know even was it a girl or a boy."
I sat frozen, hands gripping the rough wood of the bench. After a moment, there was a heavy crunching noise on the ground in front of me. I cracked my eyes open and saw that he had sat down, just as he was, on the wet gravel at my feet. He sat with bowed head, and the rain had left spangles in his damp, darkened hair.
"Will you make me beg?" he said.
"It was a girl," I said, after a moment. My voice sounded funny, hoarse and husky. "Mother Hildegard baptized her. Faith. Faith Fraser. Mother Hildegard has a very odd sense of humour." The bowed head didn't move. After a moment, he said quietly,
"Did you see the child?"
My eyes were open all the way now. I stared at my knees, where blown drops of water from the vines behind me were making wet spots on the silk. "Yes, the maîtresse sage-femme said I ought. So they made me." I could hear in memory the low, matter-of-fact tones of Madame Bonheur, most senior and respected of the midwives who gave of their time at l'Hôpital des Anges.
"Give her the child. It's always better if they see. Then they don't imagine things."
So I didn't imagine, I remembered. "She was perfect," I said softly, as though to myself. so small. I could cup her head in the palm of my hand. Her ears stuck out just a little. I could see the light shine through them. The light had shone through her skin as well, glowing in the roundness of cheek and buttock with the light that pearls have, still and cool, with a strange touch of the water world still on them.
"Mother Hildegard wrapped her in a length of white satin," I said, looking down at my fists clenched in my lap.
Her eyes were closed. She hadn't any lashes yet, but her eyes were slanted.
I said they were like yours, but they said all babies' eyes are like that.
10 fingers and 10 toes. No nails, but the gleam of tiny joints, kneecaps and finger bones like opals, like the jewelled bones of the earth itself.
Remember, man, that thou art dust.
I remembered the far-off clatter of the hôpital, where life still went on, and the subdued murmur of Mother Hildegard and Madame Bonheur, closer by, talking of the priest who would say a special mass at Mother Hildegard's request. I remembered the look of calm appraisal in Madame Bonheur's eyes as she turned to look me over, seeing my weakness. Perhaps she saw also the telltale brightness of the approaching fever. She had turned again to Mother Hildegard, and her voice had dropped further, perhaps suggesting that they wait. 2 funerals might be needed.
"And unto dust thou shalt return."
But I had come back from the dead. Only Jamie's hold on my body had been strong enough to pull me back from that final barrier, and Master Raymond had known it. I knew that only Jamie himself could pull me back the rest of the way into the land of the living. That was why I had run from him, done all I could to keep him away, to make sure he would never come near me again. I had no wish to come back, no desire to feel again. I didn't want to know love, only to have it ripped away once more. But it was too late. I knew that, even as I fought to hold the grey shroud around me. Fighting only hastened its dissolution. It was like grasping shreds of cloud that vanished in cold mist between my fingers. I could feel the light coming, blinding and searing. He had risen, was standing over me. His shadow fell across my knees. Surely that meant the cloud had broken. A shadow doesn't fall without light.
"Claire," he whispered, "please, let me give you comfort."
"Comfort," I said, "and how will you do that? Can you give me back my child?"
He sank to his knees before me, but I kept my head down, staring into my upturned hands laid empty on my lap. I felt his movement as he reached to touch me, hesitated, drew back, reached again.
"No," he said,
his voice scarcely audible.
"No, I cannot do that. But with the grace of God, I might give you another."
His hand hovered over mine, close enough that I felt the warmth of his skin. I felt other things as well, the grief that he held tight under rein, the anger and the fear that choked him, and the courage that made him speak in spite of it. I gathered my own courage around me, a flimsy substitute for the thick grey shroud. Then I took his hand and lifted my head and looked full into the face of the sun. We sat, hands clasped and pressed together on the bench, unmoving, unspeaking, for what seemed like hours, with the cool rain breeze whispering our thoughts in the great leaves above. Water drops scattered over us with the passing of the wind, weeping for loss and separation.
"You're cold," Jamie murmured at last,
and pulled a fold of his cloak around me, bringing with it the warmth of his skin. I came slowly against him under its shelter, shivering more at the startling solidness, the sudden heat of him, than from the cold. I laid my hand on his chest, tentative, as though the touch of him might burn me in truth, and so we sat for a good while longer, letting the grape leaves talk for us. "Jamie," I said softly at last. "Oh, Jamie, where were you?"
His arm tightened about me, but it was some time before he answered.
"I thought you were dead, Mudunya," he said,
so softly I could hardly hear him above the rustling of the arbour.
"I saw you there, on the ground, at the last.
God, you were so white, and your skirts all soaked with blood.
I tried to go to you, Claire, so soon as I saw...
I ran to you.
But it was then the guard took me."
He swallowed hard. I could feel the tremor pass down him through the long curve of his backbone.
"I fought them. I fought, and I pleaded. But they wouldn't stay, and they carried me away with them. And they put me in a cell and left me there, thinking you were dead, Claire, knowing that I'd killed you."
The fine tremor went on, and I knew he was weeping, though I couldn't see his face above me. How long had he sat alone in the dark of the Bastille, alone but for the scent of blood and the empty husk of vengeance?
"It's all right," I said, and pressed my hand harder against his chest, as though to still the hasty beating of his heart.
"Jamie, it's all right. It wasn't your fault." "I tried to bash my head against the wall, only to stop thinking," he said, nearly in a whisper. "So they tied me, hand and foot. And next day, de Rouen found me and told me that you lived, though likely not for long."
He was silent then, but I could feel the pain inside him, sharp as crystal spears of ice.
"Claire," he murmured at last, "I am sorry. I am sorry."
The words were those of the note he had left me before the world shattered. But now I understood them.
"I know," I said. "Jamie, I know. Fergus told me. I know why you went."
He drew a deep, shuddering breath.
"Aye, well," he said, and stopped.
I let my hand fall to his thigh. Chilled and damp from the rain, his riding breeches were rough under my palm.
"Did they tell you, when they let you go, why you were released?"
I tried to keep my own breathing steady, but failed. His thigh tensed under my hand, but his voice was under better control now.
"No," he said, "only that it was His Majesty's pleasure."
The word pleasure was ever so faintly underlined, spoken with a delicate ferocity that made it abundantly clear that he did indeed know the means of his release, whether the warders had told him or not. I bit my lower lip hard, trying to make up my mind what to tell him now.
"It was Mother Hildegard," he went on, voice steady. "I went at once to L'Hôpital des Anges in search of you, and found Mother Hildegard and the wee note you'd left for me. She told me."
"Yes," I said, swallowing.
"I went to see the king."
"I know."
His hand tightened on mine, and from the sound of his breathing, I could tell that his teeth were clenched together.
"But, Jamie, when I went..."
"Christ," he said,
and sat up suddenly, turning to face me.
"Do you not know what I... Claire?"
He closed his eyes briefly and took a deep breath.
"I rode all the way to Orvieto, seeing it. Seeing his hands on the white of your skin. His lips on your neck. His cock. I saw it at the levee. I saw the damn filthy, stubby thing sliding up. God, Claire! I sat in prison thinking you dead, and then I rode to Spain wishing to Christ you were."
The knuckles of the hand holding mine were white, and I could feel the small bones of my fingers crackle in his grip. I jerked my hand free. "Jamie, listen to me."
"No," he said, "no. I dinna want to hear. Listen, damn you!"
There was enough force in my voice to shut him up for an instant, and while he was mute, I began rapidly to tell him the story of the king's chamber, the hooded men, and the shadowed room, the sorcerer's duel, and the death of the Comte Saint-Germain. As I talked, the high colour faded from his wind-brisked cheeks, and his expression softened from anguish and fury
to bewilderment, and gradually to astonished belief.